Welcome to Island Idols.
I'm Barry Menikoff calling in from Honolulu, and you are...
Aaron Menikoff calling in from Atlanta, and this is a podcast about books and life. Welcome back to Island Idols. Here we are for episode 34, and the title of this episode is Go Look It Up, because we are talking about the dictionary. And of all the podcast episodes being dropped this week, we may be the only episode on the planet on the topic of the dictionary. And I think that is a rarefied air. Are you excited, Dad?
Well, I'm excited. I don't know why. I can't imagine there's somebody else that's not talking about the dictionary, but that's okay. I have to say before, for all the listeners, I have to make one observation and one, you know, I am not a lexicographer, okay? So everything I say is that of a practicing scholar and writer. And, of course, we all know the famous definition of a lexicographer that Samuel Johnson used in his great dictionary. A harmless drudge, that busies himself in tracing the original and detailing the signification of words. So Samuel Johnson had a little bit of a sly streak in him.
Well, that's actually something that we're going to talk about in a little while. I don't know that anyone would confuse you for a lexicographer, but I do know two things. Number one, a number of years ago when I was teaching at sort of a homeschool co-op, you were in town and you came and gave a lecture to a class of about, I don't know, 20 high school students. You gave a lecture on the dictionary. So I know that this is a topic that you are interested in. And number two, when you visited us in Georgia a few years ago, we were in a small town and we found a bookstore and you noticed Webster's third new international English Dictionary or American Dictionary, and you bought it for me, three volumes, tiny print, for my birthday. And so that's a man who cares about the dictionary. And I warmly received it, and I regularly use it.
I remember those incidents. I think one was at a coastal town where I bought the dictionary. We were going on a short visit in Oregon on the coast. And I guess it was a small store, and I was surprised to find the dictionary. And I knew something about that dictionary, and so I thought it would be something you could make use of. As far as teaching your class, I vaguely remember that. I think that was a pleasant experience.
So we want to talk today about words, and there's a lot going on in the world today. There are a lot of important things going on in the world today. There are always important things going on in the world today. And inevitably, those events and ideas are communicated in words. And so we're in a season where we're thinking about the short story. We're going to take a little break from that series. We hope to address Ernest Hemingway in episode number 35. But today, we want to talk about words. And Dad, before we get into the your sort of heart and interest for the dictionary, I want us to think a little bit about the issue of plagiarism and, if you will, the stealing of other people's words. And so this is sort of unrelated to the dictionary, trying to draw a link that makes sense. But it's actually very interesting. Dad, you may know that a number of weeks ago, the denomination that I'm a part of elected a president, which is a position of leadership in this network of churches, Baptist churches around the country. And it was discovered shortly thereafter that he had preached a sermon that was, in fact, another man's sermon, pretty much word for word. And he didn't give any attribution to that other man. Now, subsequently, he said that that other man had given him permission. You know, if it's useful to you in your church, feel free to use it. But I think a lot of people are looking at that going, well, you know, he plagiarized. And made me want to talk to you and ask the question, because you've been teaching an entire career of teaching, what is plagiarism?
Plagiarism is stealing. Essentially, plagiarism means to steal. And you're stealing somebody else's property. Actually, in the 18th century, plagiarism was used as a term for kidnapping. You know, you're stealing the theft of a child. So stealing of somebody else's words. Now, of course, you know, it has, you know, the onus of being the most terrible thing you can do, one of the most terrible things that can be done, well, in the scheme of things. But, and, you know, when it's teaching university, after a certain point, university would have all these policies about plagiarism, which they would send out in long pages to the students to make sure that they were, you know, instilling the fear of the Lord in them if they so much as plagiarized. But, of course, university students and students everywhere don't really know what plagiarism is, frankly. And the fact is, and now this is going to, I'm going to go off on a tangent. We live in a plagiarized culture. Everybody steals from everybody else. And we use a word now we call mash. You know, when people talk about mashing things, they're just taking words and taking bits from here and there and putting them together. And it's all their creation, even though it's, you know, made up of bits and pieces of other people's writing. Stevenson plagiarized in, you know, in some of his books. He would copy out documents from old, you know, ancient, you know, histories or correspondences, and he would use them in his works. And he didn't ascribe authority, or he didn't identify where they came from.
Would he have understood himself to be plagiarizing at that point, or would he have some rationale?
No, I mean, he knew the rationale was he was using something that had no other, you know, that would never see the light of day. But in his book, it was perfectly suitable for, you know, the work he was doing, and it served the purpose, and he didn't think twice about it. So I'm not saying that stealing is other people's words and using other people's words is a good thing. And I'm very, very jealous myself of my own writing, and I don't like to see other people using it. But I'm not going to go off on a high horse and, you know, say we're going to put people in the stocks for doing this. And most people, when they do it, you know, they're lazy and they can't come up with things on their own. And, you know, it becomes a shorthand for getting through their particular task of the day. They're usually not writers. Writers, generally speaking, don't plagiarize unless they're really inauthentic or unless they're really.
Did you speak to your students about plagiarism?
Of course. But, you know, plagiarism is, you know, the papers are sold on the Internet. You know, students get their papers from the Internet half the time. And unless you want to go around and start searching for where they're getting them, I mean, which is a kind of a full-time job.
Well, nowadays, I mean, you know, Dad, that nowadays it's a lot of school systems have, there's computer software that will quite easily check whether or not a student's paper has been bought or plagiarized.
Right. But the problem, I don't think, is the students. I think the problem is the education people. The students not learning how to think for themselves and learning how to, you know, value their own thoughts and their own writing and their own expression. And they have no choice when as they move further up the ladder from K through 12, they're required to do writing and they don't really know how to do it. And, you know, in university, you know, you ask a student to do a term paper, they'd go to books and they'd find books about Hemingway or Stevenson and they'd copy them out into their papers. And they think, well, they were citing them because they identified they were citing it. But that, you know, I found that very.
Do you make a distinction in communicating about plagiarism between the written word and the spoken word? I mean, if you were giving a lecture, do you feel that there's greater freedom to be liberal in your use of another source than if you're writing an academic paper or a term paper?
Not really, but I mean, if you're speaking, you know, why don't you say, as so-and-so said, you know, I mean, you know, so-and-so remarks, you know, I'm quoting from memory, you know. I used a lot of citations in my oral lectures, you know, and it was fine. You know, here's one that I've used before in this podcast for our, you know, in our discussion was from Samuel Johnson's dictionary. He says, the glory of a people derives from its authors. And by authors, he didn't mean just, you know, playwrights and poets. He meant philosophers and historians and scientists, people that wrote and put things down in writing. They were so he was a great admirer of people who wrote.
I want to get to some of these prefaces of dictionaries. We want to look at more than one, and I want to get your feedback on them, and you are already in it. But I want to get your feedback on that that real-life example of plagiarism that I gave a moment ago, because you're not someone who finds yourself sitting in the pews of Baptist churches very often, and perhaps the only time you've ever sat in the pew of a Baptist church is when your son was preaching. But I am curious. Let's just say, and I suppose, you know, rabbis give talks, right, in the synagogue? But anyway, suppose you are in a church and you were to discover that that pastor had been preaching a sermon written by another pastor, and you had gone there not being aware of that. And what would you have thought once you found that out? As someone who doesn't, you know, consider yourself a Christian, what would your reaction to that have been? Or what is it?
Well, essentially, you lose respect for the person. I mean, the person is in a position of authority or a position of leadership. And in a position of leadership, you don't steal other people's work and pass it off as your own. That's essentially what it is. And so I don't get worked up about the larger meaning of it. It becomes an individual thing. I mean, here I want to say something about words. And again, I'm going to quote Robert Louis Stevenson. He said in an interview, he said, "One thing about me, I am not a sloven." That meant, he didn't say that he dressed to the nines, but he meant when it came to using words, he was exact. He was precise. And that I've always taken to be a model. And to be exact and to be precise, here we go into the subject for today, you have to have dictionaries.
Okay. Well, that, you know, one general editor of the Webster's Dictionary said the three cardinal rules of dictionary making are accuracy, clearness, and comprehensiveness. And the greatest of those, he said, was accuracy. And I think that's very close to precision. You've already begun to unpack it, but could you help us understand your personal interest in the dictionary? I mean, even as I say it, you know, in 2021, it can sound like a ridiculous question, like who in the world is interested in the dictionary? And yet I really think you are.
Yes, I guess I am. And if you're interested in writing, you have to have a dictionary, because no matter how smart you are, or no matter how advanced you are in your English in the SATs, you never are exactly sure of the meaning of a word. And we know when you open a dictionary, a word can have a number of meanings. We use the word commonly, and so you write it commonly. You don't go think to look it up because you know the word. But if you're writing a sentence and you do not want to be a sloven, as Stevenson says, you go and you look at the dictionary to see the precise meaning that you are trying to express through that use of that word. And when you get it, you continue on. I don't know how many years I started this, but I write with the Oxford English Dictionary on my computer. So even if it's a common word, I'll stop, I'll look it up, and sometimes I find the word that I thought that was its meaning was not exactly the meaning, and I have to change.
And Dad, we're going to come to the OED in a few minutes. When you say that we need to go to the dictionary to find the meaning, it seems interesting to me that meanings can change if the usage changes. So let me give you an example. I don't remember the teacher that shared this with me, and I didn't look it up in preparation for this episode, but I recall being told by a teacher that the word peruse, in fact, means to read carefully. And yet, when the word peruse is used commonly, it is used to mean more like I flipped through this book. Let me take a second and peruse this book. Almost the opposite meaning of the technical meaning. And over time, whatever the dictionary says has to submit to what the people are using it to mean. Is that true?
Yes. Well, look, you had two conflicting views of the dictionary from its origins. Even we have to go back to Samuel Johnson, because he was the first great creator of the dictionary. And he was approached by booksellers who wanted him to create a dictionary so that they could, you know, sort of, you know, basically systematize spelling. Spelling in the 18th century was, you know, ran it every which way.
Now, kids would love that. That'd be great. Like, you know, you can't tell me how to spell that word.
That's right. Exactly. So Johnson thought to himself, he says he's going to fix this all by doing the dictionary, you know. And then as he was doing it, and he's the first one to start to use definitions or examples to define the word, you know, use a sentence that would express the word's meaning. And in the course of doing that dictionary, Johnson came to realize you can't really fix the language. You know, it's constantly changing. Now, I don't know how far Johnson would go along this, but he realized that fixing the language was a kind of, you know, fruitless pursuit. Now, if you go down into the 19th century and Noah Webster and the Webster's Dictionary, Noah Webster wanted to fix the language as well. You know, he wanted to change the spelling. He wanted to ensure people knew, you know, systematize, you know, language, spelling, and pronunciation. And people began to think that the dictionary was prescriptive. It told you what words meant and what words, how they mean, and how they ought to mean. So people couldn't use them indiscriminately because the dictionary would tell you which was right or wrong. Later on, dictionary makers came to think dictionaries were not there to tell you how words should be used, but to really describe the way words were used.
So you're saying that was a change?
Yes.
That was a change. Because, and we're really jumping around here, but in the Webster's third New International Dictionary, that I think was published in 1961, at least the preface to it was 1961, and the general editor said that exact thing. I read the preface, and he made it very clear that their aim was to see how these words were being used. And literally, you know, dozens of editors spent years reading in advance and, I suppose, compiling lists of how these words were used. And what you're saying is that's a descriptive approach. The dictionary is describing how words are being used. But there was a time in history when a dictionary was seen as prescriptive. And was that Johnson and Webster originally?
Well, yes. But even going into the 20th century, Webster's second edition, which is a great dictionary, was more prescriptive.
Okay.
Was more, you know, and the great change that the third edition made in the Webster's was it broke from that prescriptiveness and it tended towards a more, I don't want to say permissive, but a recognition that words had to be described and their usage rather than the way in which, you know, dictionary makers might think they should be used. And the third is a great edition.
Has history settled the question, or do you feel like this is a question that is still up for debate, the prescriptive versus descriptive nature of the dictionary? Or is there simply always a healthy tension?
No, I think dictionaries are pretty much, serious dictionaries are pretty much descriptive.
Okay.
I don't think anybody goes back to the prescriptive nature. Now, there are problems, and that's why you have books like books on usage, like Fowler's Modern English Usage or Garner's Modern American Usage, because those books try to describe the way the words are used and sometimes give you the impression that some usages are better than other usages. Those books are different from dictionaries. They are more aimed at giving authors or readers a chance to make a decision. Now, if you take an example like the word enormity. Most people use the word enormity today to mean enormousness. That's not what the word means.
Okay, that's what I would assume it means. I never used that word, but I would have assumed that. The enormity of a situation,
No, it means the horror. The Shoah or the Holocaust would be described as an enormity.
Okay, the pandemic is an enormity.
Yes, you could say that. But people don't use it that way anymore. Any more than disinterest. People use disinterest and they think it means uninterested. They don't use it in the sense of impartial. Now, some people, older people like myself, would say I can't use disinterest in the sense of impartial, because it means without prejudice. It means you're looking at it at an argument, or you're looking at a situation with disinterestedly, meaning without prejudice or without any kind of bias.
So a judge should be disinterested.
Absolutely.
In the sense that he seeks to uphold the law.
Exactly.
He should be disinterested. He should be impartial. But we use it as, we use it to mean uninterested.
That's right. So if you get to the current dictionaries, is going to describe disinterested to mean impartial, but it will also have a definition that means, you see, uninterested, because that's people use it. So that's why dictionaries have to constantly be revised to take into account of the changing language.
All right, well, you shared a little bit of Johnson. I think it'd be fun to read a little bit from his preface and just get your thoughts on it. Are you ready?
Sure, go ahead.
This is Johnson. Among these unhappy mortals is the writer of dictionaries, whom mankind have considered not as the pupil, but the slave of science, the pioneer of literature, doomed only to remove rubbish and clear obstructions from the paths through which learning and genius press forward to conquest and glory, without bestowing a smile on the humble drudge that facilitates their progress. Every other author may aspire to praise. The lexicographer can only hope to escape reproach. And even this negative recompense has been yet granted to very few.
Well, I think it's Johnson's way of both telling people, look, this is an enormous labor. I'm not going to get rewarded for it or recognized, and people are not going to remember me for it. But of course, in reality, it's not true. I mean, Johnson is remembered for the dictionary. He's remembered for some of his famous quotes in the dictionary, for definitions. And they're quoted more often than he actually. Most of the dictionary is pretty, he's pretty hard-nosed. But, a few came out, like oats. Oats is what in England they feed the horses, and in Scotland they feed the people. That's always used as an example of his view of the Scottish people.
Let me give you another section. You've already quoted the most famous line. Let me read it in context, and perhaps you can expand upon Johnson. He writes, in hope of giving longevity to that which its own nature forbids to be immortal, I have devoted this book, the labor of years, to the honor of my country, that we may no longer yield the palm of philology without a contest to the nations of the continent. The chief glory of every people arises from its authors. Whether I shall add anything by my own writings to the reputation of English literature must be left to time. Much of my life has been lost under the pressures of disease. Much has been trifled away, and much has always been spent in provision for the day that was passing over me. But I shall not think my employment useless or ignoble if by my assistance foreign nations and distant ages gain access to the propagators of knowledge and understand the teachers of truth. If my labors afford light to the repositories of science and add celebrity to Bacon, to Hooker, to Milton, and to Boyle.
Well, what do you want me to say to that? It's Johnson's peroration. But, those last references, what he's really saying and what he established, and of course was brought to fruition, brought by the OED and the later Webster's, was drawing on authors to signify, the use of language. And of course, they tended to, in Johnson's day and later, they tended to, rely on great figures. But with the OED, they came to rely on more popular writing. And so now it doesn't matter, today, if you look into a Webster's and there's a quotation, the quotation is likely to come from a popular magazine or a television script, you see, whereas in the early days, it would come from, your major figures.
Right. No. Well, and maybe we can turn our attention for just a moment to the creation of words, which is, I know, is a different topic, but really, really interesting. So before we get into I want to talk about Webster before we talk about the OED, but William Tyndale lived in the 16th century, 1494 to 1536, famous for translating the Bible into the English language, his Bible printed in 1526. And many of the words found in these early English Bibles, the Tyndale Bible, the Coverdale Bible, ended up being words that were in the English language for the first time. So apparently Tyndale is credited with words like anathema, beggarly, brotherly, castaway, chasten, and behold. Meanwhile, Shakespeare, 1564 to 1616, so about a generation later, credited with about 420 words. I'm going to use the word invented, but maybe you can speak to that. Words ranging from bloodsucking to cheap, hellborn, and money's worth. So these are words being created. Can you talk a little bit about the creation of words?
Well, I would say that modern English starts to explode in the period you're talking about, between Tyndale and the 17th century. You have the great explosion of language. And Shakespeare is credited not with 400 new words, but with over 1,400. So by new words, it means that from the dictionary point of view, it's the first time a word is found. By found, you can say it's found in any printed source or a manuscript source. And dictionaries do this ever since, you know, ever since the OED, which started to calculate them. They start citing the first time a word is used. Now, a writer like at the same period, the great, humanist Roger Ascham, who wrote a book, Toxophilus, about archery, but it was really a book about writing. You know, he's credited with, I'm trying to see how I checked it up, with only 995 first words used, but 940 quotations. So that somebody from as early as the 16th century, like Roger Ascham, is being used as a source to find credible definitions, or what Johnson called the signification of a word. Now, that goes on all the time. New words are being created all the time. Today, of course, they're being created, it seems like, like Topsy. They're growing like Topsy. And there you'll find them in more current, you know, outlets, urban dictionaries, things that are, you know, very much more immediate. But for the classic dictionaries, they would find writers who often, you know, are cited for the first use of words. That would be the first use of a word. And that's...
Dad, is a distinction made between a word that exists that's used in a unique way? So, for example, to Google, right? I didn't look it up, but I presume that Google is now found in some dictionary as a verb, to Google.
Right.
That's different than the sort of the creativity I think of when I think of a Shakespeare. Is there a distinction between how words are created?
I don't really think so. I mean, they're created by the originators of them. They use them in their own particular way. And often they'll take a word that's a common word and use it differently. So, for example, you'll get in the OED not just the first evidence of a word, but the first evidence of the word in a particular meaning, you see, which is different. First evidence means it's the first time they've seen the word. First evidence of the sense of the word is how it's used by a particular writer. And somebody like Robert Louis Stevenson, it's very easy to find the statistics here, is quoted as having 258 first evidences of senses. That is, in other words, 258 times, or 258 quotations of Stevenson, it's the first time the word was used in that particular sense.
Really?
Yes. Stevenson is very high on the OED's quotation list. Johnson is even higher.
Okay. Let's go back to Webster for a moment. In 1806, Noah Webster publishes a compendious dictionary of the English language, and in 1828, he publishes an American dictionary of the English language. You've already mentioned he documented American words. He altered spelling. So center, C-E-N-T-R-E, was changed to C-E-N-T-E-R. By the way, can you explain why that happened? What was the deal with that? Why didn't we just keep it?
I mean, Webster thought that he was simplifying the spelling of words by changing that. I mean, nobody says centra. Everybody says center. So why spell center C-R-E instead of E-R, which made sense the way how it sounded? Why do you have honor, H-O-N-O-U-R, when the U doesn't have any sound or doesn't have any meaning? So why not just make it H-O-N-O-R? So that's why we have favor, honor, color with no U. Whereas in English, they still have the U's there. He said he changed the S in words to the Z. Surprise. Nobody says surprise, S-U-R-P-R-I-S-E. Everybody says S-U-R-P-R-I-Z-E. That's how it sounds. So Webster made the change to spelling it that way.
Seems like that takes a little gumption.
Absolutely. Not a lot of the things, you know, worked. I mean, he wanted to change tongue, T-O-N-G-U-E, to T-U-N-G, tongue.
Well, that seems like a good one.
It didn't work. So, you know, you have to get the acceptance on the part of the population.
This reminds me of third grade when I was in class and there was a spelling bee. And I made it to the finals. It was just me and another kid. And the word was ocean. And I spelled it wrong. And I remember that to this day. It's kind of a hard word to spell. Do you know how to spell it?
Ocean?
Yeah.
O-C-E-A-N.
Yeah. Well, I didn't spell it that way. So George and Charles Merriam bought the unsold copies and the publishing rights to Webster's Dictionary. In 1847, they published a revised edition by Webster's son-in-law, a professor at Yale College. So, Dad, let me read to you from his preface to the 1828 Dictionary, and maybe you can just comment on our good friend Noah. All right?
Okay.
If the language can be improved in regularity, so as to be more easily acquired by our own citizens and by foreigners, and thus be rendered a more useful instrument for the propagation of science, arts, civilization, and Christianity, if it can be rescued from the mischievous influence of schialists and that dabbling spirit of innovation which is perpetually disturbing its settled usages and filling it with anomalies, if, in short, our vernacular language can be redeemed from corruptions and our philology and literature from degradation, it would be a source of great satisfaction to me to be one among the instruments of promoting these valuable objects. If this object cannot be effected and my wishes and hopes are to be frustrated, my labor will be lost and this work must sink into oblivion.
Webster wanted to, as we said earlier, he wanted to regularize the language. He wanted to create an American dictionary that he thought would reflect the American speech and the American population, you know, taking all the immigrants and giving them something that would be systematic and would be similar for everybody. It was a way of trying to establish a difference between America and Britain and to establish in the language, give the people a book that would make them know that they were American. The way they wrote and the way they spoke was different from the way the English spoke and wrote. And this really was a larger purpose in mind. So this was where the prescriptive element comes through.
Right. But Dad, that seems to me like half of it, because he goes on to talk about the way language is. He talks about an instrument for the propagation, and he lists, you know, science and art and civilization and even, you know, Christianity. But the larger point is he saw the need for a standardized language because without that standardization, he's arguing something of intellect and accomplishment in the arts and in the sciences and religion, it's going to be lost.
Well, that's because there's a belief that there's some kind of standard to which everybody ought to, you know, subscribe. Even in England, for example, not everybody spoke the same way. You had people speaking dialects that would almost be incomprehensible to English speakers. If people speaking, what about the way the Scots spoke? Well, could you say Scots is not English, but even Northern England. So you had to have, you know,
people who wanted to fix the language wanted to get rid of that. They wanted to have some universal system that was appropriate for the entire people. But over time, I think in the late and in the 19th century, people began to realize that this was not only not possible, but it was also desirable to record the way people actually spoke. So you had something like the English Dialect Dictionary, which captured the words and the phrases that were used in Northern England and parts of Southern Scotland. It's a very important dictionary. And by the time the OED starts to undergo its development, they really started to get rid of the prescriptive notion and try to approach dictionary making as a process of empirical description.
You've talked a lot about the OED already. We can turn to that now because it was in 1857 that the Philological Society of London, and Dad, what is a philological society? I mean, goodness gracious.
Society of language. Philology is a study of language.
So would these have been like professors at Cambridge and Oxford getting together for a word club?
No, there would be people who had a special interest in language and in and often the language of the little of the regions that they lived in. And they were just wordsmiths. They weren't all professors. Some of them, you know, I don't even know if James Murray was a professor at Oxford or not, frankly. The lead, you know, director of the OED, of the Oxford English Dictionary.
Dad, do you ever say I'm fixing to get me something to eat?
I might say that. I don't know if I'd say that, but I couldn't.
You would not never say. That's what they say in the South. I'm fixing to do something. Would a philologist study that?
Sure. I mean, for example, what I said when I grew up in Jewish households, we would say, make dinner. Nobody would say prepare dinner. And I remember going to school, our teachers would always be trying to correct us. You don't say make dinner, you say prepare dinner.
All right, so in 1879, this society partners with Oxford University Press, and they hired James A.H. Murray to be the first editor. And they expected a four-volume work with about 6,400 pages. And 5 years into the project, they were only as far as the word ant. And so they quickly realized this was a bigger project than anyone had expected. And apparently the last volume of the Oxford English Dictionary would not be completed until April of 1928, 71 years later, with 10 volumes. And I think I read that it's never made any money. Dad, let's just, I'm just going to, the floor is open, Dad. What do you want to say about the Oxford English Dictionary? Have at it.
Well, it was originally called the New English Dictionary. It was published at Oxford, but this title was the NED, the New English Dictionary. And those volumes are still available. But at some point, I think maybe in 28, they changed the title to the Oxford English Dictionary. Oxford was taking, you know, pride in its production. One of the things they did was try to develop in the citations, in the quotations that they used for the definitions of words, to start them historically. So you'd have the earliest citation of the earliest time they could find a word, and then you'd find its use through the centuries till the latest time.
So would that be like, let's find like the Old English usage versus the Middle English usage versus maybe modern?
Right, correct, absolutely. And that was a great contribution. And so you suddenly started the subtitle, the dictionary based on historical principles. So they would try to find the history of the word insofar as they could. You know, there was a very popular book written several years ago called The Professor and the Madman about how, you know, what they did was Murray had all lists of readers, people he had reading constantly. So they would have, that's where they would find the quotations. So he had somebody who was always sending them quotations, and he was living in an institution in England. And can't remember the name of the author who wrote that book. It became very popular, and actually I think they even made a movie out of it.
So is that why you use the OED, because it gives you the history of the words in a way that like a Webster's dictionary doesn't?
Yes, absolutely, because you could find when the word was early, when it was used, when it was its earliest use, and also, you know, you could find that you learn a lot about the use, about the meaning of the word on, you know, depending upon its usage. And then, of course, it would have all these quotations by people, you know, authors, how it was used. So it was a treasure trove of language.
Now, Dad, let's bring this into the more modern times, but I want to go to 1961, and I want to go to the preface of the dictionary you gave me that you actually purchased for me in Blue Ridge, Georgia. So that was not on the coast. It was in Blue Ridge. And Philip Grove wrote this, and I thought it was fascinating, this preface. And times have changed. So let me read this to you and get your reflections on it. So this is what Grove writes. As the number of students in school and college jumps to an ever-increasing heights, the quantity of printed matter necessary to their education increases too. Not only are more words used more often with these increases, words must be used more economically and more efficiently, both in school and out. More and more do people undertaking a new job, practicing a new hobby, or developing a new interest turn to how-to pamphlets, manuals, and books for both elementary instruction and advanced guidance. Where formerly they had time to learn by doing, they now need to begin by reading and understanding what has been recorded. A quick grasp of the meanings of words becomes necessary if one is to be successful. A dictionary opens the way to both formal learning and to the daily self-instruction that modern living requires. It is the key to the daily newspaper and to a vast number of other periodicals that demand our attention. I mean, there's a lot there, isn't it? I mean, he's writing in the, you know, this is the fruit of work that happened in the 50s. This is quite a different approach. I mean, he's arguing that if you want to be successful in the modern world, you need to make use of the dictionary.
I don't know how to answer that or whether to speak to that. I mean, I believe, you know, if you look at the dictionary as something that enables you to clarify your own thinking and your own writing, I think that's great. I mean, it's an arbiter and it's an aid for expression and for thinking. I mean, it's not going to solve any problems. I don't think the dictionary is going to get you a job and make you improve your success. I mean, you know, in the old days, they used to say, well, you know, if you read, you learn more words. The more you read, the more your vocabulary will develop and grow. I don't know if they say that anymore. I was just reading, you know, yesterday an article about the Chronicle of Higher Education about the books that freshmen are expected to read in college, and everything was after 2010. You know, so what can I say? I mean,
well, I think you can read that. I read that paragraph and I think to myself, I think someone could take these words and make an argument the dictionaries are less important today than they once were. So, for example, today, if you want to know how to fix your sink, or if you want to know how to fix your car, you're probably not going to turn to a how-to manual on your shelf. You're going to turn to YouTube. And you're going to watch someone do it. So you don't need to know that thing is called a plier. You don't need to know the names of the tools or the names of the bolts. You just learn by watching. It's a visual world. And I can't help but think that that implies a slight depreciation in the value of dictionaries, at least according to this general editor's apology.
Well, that may be. I mean, if you're trying to say that we're going to lose all sense of language, I mean, you know, I don't know how to answer that. Clearly, the value that I find in a dictionary comes from, you know, the value I place in exact writing. You know, the old quote from Francis Bacon, you know, writing maketh an exact man, a precise man, you know, and I don't know how you can do that. I mean, if you're going to use words, if you're caught in the web of words, the way somebody wrote about James Murray, you know, you have to be precise and you have to know what the word is. You have to know where it comes from and what it means. And if you don't care about that, if you're trying to say, what does it mean for the world at large? Look, nobody uses apostrophes. So you're going to go to you're not going to go to a book of usage where they'll tell you IT apostrophe S means it is, and people don't want to use it. I mean, the apostrophe, so then you'll get people who are permissive and say, well, nobody uses apostrophe, so why bother with it? What can I say? I remember being in Southern California, and there was a Nordstrom's there, and in the store where the ladies' shoes were, there was a big sign on the top that says "Ladies' Shoes," LADIE apostrophe S, "Ladies' Shoes," and that was Nordstrom's. Nobody seemed to care. I mean, so I was not ready to. I'm not waging a battle against it. I mean, so they want to drop the apostrophe since they're using it incorrectly in the first place. Go ahead.
So they had LADIES space shoes?
No, LADIE apostrophe S for ladies.
Oh, okay. And it should have been what?
S apostrophe.
S apostrophe. Okay. So, Dad, today, I think the vast majority of people, if they want to look up a dictionary on a word, there's an app that Apple gives you. It comes with your phone. It's on your laptop. And so they're not looking things up in a paper dictionary anymore. Can you, for a moment, what's lost?
I don't even know. I don't know what to say.
Think of it this way. Think about maybe someone starting college or someone, you know, 4-year academic career, someone maybe who is going to be thinking and writing a little bit. What's lost if all they're doing is relying upon, let's say, an abbreviated dictionary entry that comes embedded in your computer program? Is anything lost?
Well, they really don't have a sense of the value of words, and they're not sensitive to the complexity of words. When I taught freshman English, which at the University of Hawaii we had to do even though you were a full professor, when I taught freshman English, I required them to have a dictionary and bring it to class every day. Because we would do reading, and then I would stop and I'd say, what does that word mean? And then I'd have them look it up, and they would get really, they'd get PO'd. You know, they'd say, I don't want to stop and look this word up, you know, why should I bother? But I just, that was the insistence I made, you know, look it up. And then they'd look it up, and then they'd read it out, and they'd learn something, that, you know, the word meant something. And the way you find out its meaning is you research it. You research it through the dictionary. How is it described? Is it an adjective? Is it an adverb? How is it used? Is it colloquial? Is it informal? Is it common? You know, they learn something about the language, and it doesn't come easily. You have to work at it. And if you don't do it, I mean, if you just check your app and you get the first meaning and definition, that's, you know, you become what Stevenson said he was not. You become a sloven with respect to language. And I'm afraid that's very common.
Hey, Dad, our podcasts are on the long side, and we don't apologize for that. People can listen or not listen at their discretion. It's free. So there you have it. But let's give a little treat to those who have listened for the entirety of the podcast. And let's end with a proof that words, that people are passionate about words. People who might have been dismissive of this entire podcast about the dictionary are in fact passionate about words. And all we need to do is bring up the 21st century pronoun debate to prove that people really do care about the meaning of words and what those words convey. And they get to the heart of who we understand ourselves to be or not to be. I'm old enough to remember when his truly was gender neutral. I mean, I was taught in elementary school that when I encounter his, I'm not to think male, but to think this is used as a stand-in for his or her, for a person. As time went on, I was taught to either say to write his or her, or use sometimes his or sometimes her, but I was taught never to use they, to pick one or the other. These days are long past, and now on the front pages of newspapers across America are stories of individuals saying, my preferred pronoun is they, or and so forth and so on. Dad, I know that you are very respectful of people's freedom to identify as they choose to identify. You've talked about trying to go with the times and not be stuck in the past. But sometimes the future has a way of blowing up our dictionaries. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts that you'd be willing to share publicly about this gender pronoun debate that, you know, in the next 50 years could truly change writing forever.
Look, I have my preferences. I have a hard time using they as a pronoun for his or her or their, you know. I recognize that. But I also recognize that there's a population that's expressing itself, and it expresses itself through language, and that language is going to be altered from what I knew it to be, or from what it historically was, because of the population and the people's usage of it. And there's no way you can set up a barrier as to, you know, holding it back any more than Samuel Johnson could, any more than Noah Webster really could. Language will make its own way in the world, and it will change and evolve as the population changes and evolves. And we can decry it, but you don't have to give into it in your lifetime, but you have to recognize that it's a force. It's not going to die. The language won't die. It will just change. You know, we don't speak Shakespeare's language, or whether Shakespeare created still exists with us.
Right, right. One of the things that Sammy Johnson said in right after he talks about the glory of a nation is in its authors, he writes about the propagators of knowledge and understanding the teachers of truth, the teachers of truth. And it's interesting, you know, we talked a few episodes ago about, you know, is beauty in the eye of the beholder? Are there any absolute standards of what is in fact beautiful? And we had a very interesting conversation about that. Something's going to happen in 50 years when we open up the dictionary. And right now, believe it or not, I'm not trying to be partisan or even necessarily religious, but I'm simply observing we're going to open the dictionary and look up the word man and look up the word woman and look up the word gender, and look up the word sex. And I wonder if at the top of the list in the OED is going to be the usage, and you're going to have to go way down to the bottom of the list to find out that a woman is someone born with ovaries.
You're going to have a lot of definitions. That's right. And the OED now is online, so it's constantly changing. You know, they're no longer printing an edition. That's why I can work with it. I could just keep it on the base of my computer and constantly call it up and see the word's current usage as much as it is.
And I would say that the less unity we have as a culture, the less useful our dictionaries are.
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say that. I mean, a dictionary is, as long as people are writing and as long as people want to express themselves as precisely as they can, dictionaries serve a purpose. And if you don't care about expressing yourself carefully, if you look at politics, nobody expresses themselves clearly in politics. They use phrases, they use words, and the words, then people pick them up and they respond to them. They think they know what the words mean, but what do they really mean? I don't think people could give you definitions of these words. I mean, one of the things today is that critical race theory. I mean, if you ask the person in the street, what does critical race theory mean? What do those three words actually mean? I don't think you would get a very exact definition. Who would know? You know?
That's a great example of a word that's commonly used with tons of different definitions. Dad, if someone said, you know what, okay, I'd like to take dictionaries a little bit more seriously, what would you suggest that person do?
Well, I think the Webster's online dictionary is a very good dictionary. It's a very good, simple, immediate source for language usage. I don't think people have to go to the OED. I think Webster's, you know, online, the Merriam-Webster's online dictionary is a very good introduction to, you know, language usage. Then if you get a little more sophisticated, then you have to go to some of the print dictionaries. You have to go to the Webster's Third. And Webster's Third is a great dictionary. You know, I say I've used the online, the OED, but, you know, I used the Webster's a lot, too, because the Webster's has more of an American cast to it. There is a difference between the OED and the American Dictionaries.
Well, Dad, I want to thank you for purchasing for me Webster's Third. I use it as I prepare sermons. You know, I am in the business of words, and I want to communicate clearly. I want to communicate accurately. And I'm helped at times by looking a word up in the dictionary before I use it. And I got to be honest, you know, I read a fair bit and I find words that I don't understand. You know, I don't always do it, I have to confess, but I try to look them up. So this has been a fascinating conversation. Dad, thanks for your interest in words. And our expectation in our next episode is to look at a few words of that famous author, Ernest Hemingway. So, Dad, thanks for the time, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Okay, Aaron, take care.